Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations stance point. With your host, Dan Rennie.
Yeah, good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands we are broadcasting from here in the west end of Brisbane, and of course respect and pay respects to all the traditional owners of all the lands where this program goes out to. Also like to acknowledge our elders past and present. Well, my name's Dan Rennie, with you for the regular Friday edition of Let's Talk. And the second half of the show, going to be speaking with Green Senator Lydia Thorpe, who of course was sworn in on Tuesday. But right now I have a very special guest in the studio with us. He is an elder in the community and a wealth of knowledge. Uncle Willie Prince, welcome to Let's Talk. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Dan.
Firstly, you're mob and your country.
I was born in Waka Waka country in Cherbourg. Even though I was born there, I have Kalkadoon heritage from Mount Isa. Through my grandmother's mob, through Cloncurry.
Tell us your early days, because I've yarned to you in the past, and your story is it's a powerful one.
Well, I have a long and painful history to tell. It's quite pleasant, you know, and throughout my life that I experienced. For instance, I was born on the 13th of October, 1960. If anybody remembers the 1967 referendum, anybody that was born before the 1967 referendum was still under the Act, the Native Fauna Act, and was under the care of the government of the day, who had them. And the government looked after the lives of people by removing them from community and placing them on Aboriginal reserves, such as Cherbourg or Warrabinda or Palm Island, etc. Yes, at the time of my birth, there was something wrong with me. I got sick about 16 times before my second birthday, and the doctors in Mergen didn't know what was happening, because each time that I was being admitted during those times, you know, they couldn't find an answer. And it got to the stage where the state medical doctor, at the time, there were two men that were the most powerful people in the state of Queensland, and they were appointed by the government of the day. One was the chief protector, or the administrator, the person that looked after your affairs while you were living on missions, and you had to be accountable to that person. And the other person was the state medical doctor. The state medical doctor had equal or absolute power over the lives of Aboriginal people, and as such, when the issue of my going in and out of the hospital that many times, it became a concern. And so the state medical doctor stepped in to find out what was going on and why there was a reason for me being admitted into the hospital so many times. The state medical doctor and the chief protector at the time, or the administrator, sat down at the table to decide my future. Mm. They were deliberating over it for a while. And what I understand was, with a stroke of a pen, I was removed from family, culture, and community, and placed into governmental care, and then institutionalized for several years. with hardly any contact with members of my family or community. And so the sad part about that is that was that I didn't even know that I was Aboriginal.
You weren't told.
I was too young.
Mm.
I went straight from a young baby, you know, and transferred to the Royal Brisbane Hospital, where for further diagnostic investigations as to why I was getting sick, and thus I was then diagnosed by a visiting specialist from England. I was diagnosed not by an Australian doctor but by a visiting doctor from overseas. And I guess at the time I thought, you know, and looking back at it, how ironic was that to him, you know, given the opportunity to try and diagnose what was wrong with a young Aboriginal baby, why he was getting sick so many times and why this baby had a disability, you know, and it was like a notch in his belt sort of thing, because he had the opportunity to try and come up with some sort of diagnosis and so forth, you know, which, you know, I think, you know, gave him that sort of proud sort of thing, you know. I'm the doctor who diagnosed this baby, you know, and where no Australian doctors had a chance to do that to me. Yeah, so I was, you know, he diagnosed me, and they then decided that they was going to be under government care, so I became what they call a ward of the state. So I was then totally removed from community and had little to no contact with family. And at the time, because it was very hard, because at that time of my removal, the family wouldn't have been able to see me anyway, because of the fact was that they still, they'd come and visit me, they would have to get permission from the chief administrator in Cherbourg in order to get permission to travel and have a pass. So it was very hard on my family, you know, to do that, because none of them really could afford the travel, and they had to wait, you know, a whole day just to get a travel document, you know, and permission and some sort of financial assistance from the Department of Native Affairs at the time. It was very hard, I would imagine,
yes,
for them to do so.
And so raised in government institutions till what age?
Age 17.
And then what?
I was old enough to move out and put in the community. Yeah.
And what was the diagnosis? What is the condition?
I got what they call cerebral palsy, spastic quadriplegia. Yeah.
And that was diagnosed by the visiting doctor at that very early age?
Yes. Mm. Mm. And he felt very pleased with that. But I must mention that why he was diagnosing me and all that, I later found out through records that I have managed to obtain through the Department of Aboriginal Affairs. I got a pile about, that high on me.
It's like a foot high.
Foot high. I didn't even realise that Aboriginal people with disabilities would be subject to government files. Everything that was related to me, this young boy needed clothes, this young boy needed shoes, this young boy needed to go to the dentist, all had to get permission and signed by the government in order for me to do travel. Even though I was not on a mission and I had to obtain permission, being awarded a state and under the care of government of the day, my life was controlled from day one. The moment that I went into institutionalised care and into government control care.
Uncle, what age were you when you found out you were Aboriginal and you had family and mob in community?
Yeah.
What age were you?
It was like in my teenage years. That's when I decided to find out who I was and what I was. Because one particular incident that really triggered it off, my curiosity was, one incident was when I was in this institution, Xavier Home for Crippled Children, I was in the playground with all the other children and just mucking about, minding their own business, but mucking around. And one of the kids approached me and said to me that, "You're different," which made me wonder and ask him, "Why do you think I look different?" I said to him, "I look no different than you. We're all in wheelchairs. I've got a wheelchair, you got a wheelchair, that kid over there's got a wheelchair, and so forth. So we're all in wheelchairs. What's the difference here?" He simply said, "Oh, straight out, you're black." I didn't know what he was talking about because I was never told that I was Aboriginal or had a hint that I was to that effect. It was later during that day that that one of the nuns put me aside and explained it to me, that the reason why this kid called me different and that, you know, being called black. And I asked one of the nuns there, I said, "Why did he say that, you know, and what's Aboriginal? What's an Aboriginal?" I didn't know. But to be told, not by a member of our community, but by a member of the religious order, a nun, telling me that I was Aboriginal, I didn't really comprehend that much about, because I couldn't relate to the nun telling me that I was Aboriginal, because I had nothing or nobody to refer to.
No reference point,
because there was no one there who I could look at or reference point, as you say, to tell me, you know, that I was Aboriginal.
Okay, so when did that realization come about? How old were you? And
I was just in my, just coming into my teenage years.
Yes, and when were you able to reconnect with your family and your mom?
I connected with my family on and off over those years, but it was still under the watchful eye and the control by the government of the day. For instance, if I wanted to go to Cherbourg, the nuns used to have to get an application form and send it into the government of the day to say that Willie's family wants him home for the holidays, you know, and so forth. And so even though I wasn't signing the permission form, it was done for me by the government of the day for me to travel. And one of the speculations of that condition was that I had to be met at either end. So if I got on a bus, the Greyhound bus at South Brisbane in Melbourne Street, there near the State Library, I would have to be met there by a government official to be put on the bus, and that person would tell the driver to take this person directly to Cherbourg, wait until somebody met me. Then once I got picked up, he could then go. And the family would then take me to Cherbourg. And that happened a number of times.
So what happened when you're 17, you're old enough to do your own thing? What happens then?
After that incident in the home about being told that I was different, that spurred me on even more to find out more about myself, my culture, and my family. Even though that I didn't see them that often, it was unfortunate because I missed out on those years, those early years of being with family. That was the crucial point in my life, because I missed that connection, that crucial connection with family and community. at that very point because I was institutionalised. I was still under the care of the government.
You've been a fixture around these parts for many, many years. Around South Brisbane, West End, of course, the State Library. Tell us about your time around here and some of the changes that you've experienced or witnessed.
So what I manage, as I mentioned earlier, I managed to get hold of some of my personal records from the Department of Native Affairs. And while I was going through them, I was amazed to read the part where that English doctor who was diagnosing me at that time when I came to Brisbane, I found out that he wanted to adopt me. Had he been successful in that area, I would have been living in England to this very day. I then later found out also that my mother never signed release papers. Had she done that, I would have been on the open market for adoption. But even though that happened, I was still put on the market for adoption, where I later found out that the Courier Mail took some photographs of me as a child in the institution, and that photograph that they took was sort of more or less like the stepping stone of introducing me out there to anyone that would like to adopt me. But they couldn't really adopt me because of my mother never signed release papers. But that still happened. And I thank my mother, looking back at it, and I thank my mother for that, because had she signed release papers, my life might have been different. I would not try to imagine what it was like now, because you hear stories of Aboriginal kids being taken away as children and removed from family, culture and country and placed overseas. And you hear stories, you know, and you hear stories, the anguish of the families, you know, of their children being separated. Anyways, I thank my mother for that, because in doing so, I think it more or less helped me define who I was, because as I grew older, I became more curious about who I was and where I came from, and wanted to know more about my family, and that, because, and later on, I had the opportunity to do that. But several years later, I had the opportunity to work for the State Library of Queensland. I first worked for the Indigenous Library Services. My first job placement at the State Library of Queensland was at the Public Library Service. And that part of the library or section of the library looked after and catered for people who lived in country areas, like if you lived in town of Cherbourg, Mergen or anywhere, we helped set up the libraries there. And so that was my first opportunity at that time at the library. And then I slowly worked at the Indigenous Library Services for a number of years. And then I worked at Cooldargan Indigenous Knowledge Centre, as it was called at the time. But it's now Cooldargan. I worked there. It was great. I had an opportunity to work with a great bunch of people who were like-minded like myself. Mm. We all had our people, our culture and issues, you know, where we could relate to. And, you know, and by doing that, that helped me, I suppose, give me a greater understanding of where I was from and who I was. It also gave me an opportunity to enjoy what I liked being doing, working in Cooldargan all those many years. I've now worked, at that time, I've worked for Cooldargan for 33 years. And over the years, I was able to gain a lot more knowledge and understanding about my culture and where I was from, which gave me an insight. And I was able to help others who were wanting to find out more about their culture or where they come from, or just simply wanted to come into the Cooldargan to talk to somebody, to get a cup of tea, you know, like that, you know, and yarn, just a place to sit down for a while and contemplate, you know, and relax.
Yes.
You know, in a culturally appropriate setting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what it feels like every time you go to Cooldargan, especially, you know, that outdoor little area where the fire pit is. It feels like a safe place, and the people there are so welcoming, warming, and it's a pleasurable place to visit.
Mm. I was, before Cooldargan became in existence, I was part of a community organ with a community consultation into the community wanted a place at the State Library where they wanted a place where they can come and relax, speak to somebody, or some showcases, exhibitions that were being showcased at the time, or, you know, visiting some artists, you know, giving them the opportunity to showcase their talent, their artwork in a culturally appropriate space. Myself and Uncle Sam Watson and several other members of the community, we all sat down to decide, you know, that we wanted this area of the State Library to be totally dedicated to Aboriginal people, and a space where people, not only Aboriginal people but non-Aboriginal people, can come in and learn about our culture and to understand our culture. And,
Well, Uncle, we certainly appreciate you coming in and sharing your story with us, and congratulations on an amazing 33 years at Cooldargan and, of course, recently retired. We hope you relax and enjoy your retirement. And thank you for coming in today, Uncle Willie Prince.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, we're going to be speaking with Senator Lydia Thorpe.
If your burden's too heavy, that is going to break you, and you might go crashing to the ground. Keep yourself steady and don't let it take you on down. Well, I'm here beside you, and don't you forget it, I'm with you walking down this road. Give up what's inside you, you won't regret it. Together we can lighten this load. Same for me when I was in trouble. I wanted to disappear out of sight. You wouldn't let me. You were so stubborn. You brought me out of that dark night.
host, Dan Rennie.
Well, of course, history made this week as Lydia Thorpe has become the first Aboriginal woman to represent Victoria in the Senate, just as she was the first Aboriginal woman in the state parliament. The new Green Senator was sworn in on Tuesday, replacing former leader Richard Di Natale. She, of course, that powerful and striking image of her entering the chamber, wearing the possum skin cloak, black power salute and the message stick. It was a powerful moment for, I think, all Australians, but in particular, First Nations mob. And it's my pleasure to welcome her to Let's Talk. Good morning, sis.
Good morning.
Firstly, can you tell us your mob and your country?
Sure. I'm Ganai Gunditjmara, Djaparung woman, and I'm currently on Ngambri and Ngunnawal country in Parliament House on stolen land.
What powerful images, I said at the beginning, of you walking in there, and I think a lot of the people in the room were quite stunned, but people in our communities were filled with pride and solidarity with you, especially with the Black Power salute and the message stick. Can you talk us through the steps into the chamber there?
It was, it was something that I thought about the night before, actually. I was just, contemplating swearing allegiance to the coloniser and how that made me feel personally, and the struggles that we've had as a people over the last 240 years. And I just didn't want to, walk up to the desk and follow the normal protocol. I wanted to first be welcomed and make sure that I followed protocol with the traditional owners down at the embassy, which has been a part of my life and my our people's struggle and resistance at the embassy. So that was very important for me to have that support and gain that strength to be able to walk up the road to this place that I'm in right now. And, I felt a lot better having been smoked and having elders around me and just putting my arms around my people just gave me strength and took away a little bit of the nervousness feeling that I had that morning. Mm. So then to walk in to this place, I just felt compelled to send a strong signal to the rest of this country, in particular that chamber, that I'm coming in this place to continually remind you of what is going on out there with our people. And, the fist was certainly a symbol of our power and our strength and our solidarity as a people. And, they needed to be reminded of that. It also was about the message stick bearing those 441 markings on them, which obviously represents too many Aboriginal deaths in custody or the hands of this racist system. And so, I needed to send a very strong message. We did, because it's Blackfella Radio, I can tell you a few little candid moments.
Please
that we
do.
Did have. We did have a rehearsal in the morning at 8 o'clock, and that was without the message stick and obviously without my cloak and so forth. But when I first read out the allegiance, I said hares instead of heirs. And what Blackfellas say, hey. Hey, hares, how you going? And the clerk had to tell one of my staff members, can you tell the senator that it's heirs and not hares? And I just said, how funny is that? That's a good episode of black comedy right there.
100%. Now, look, you mentioned that you were conflicted and a little bit torn about pledging allegiance to the Queen or the coloniser. Many have come at you and said it contradicts many of the stances that you've made in the past or the statements that you've made. I look at it this way, that how do we affect change if we don't have a seat at the table? I know you've even copped flak from mob in your own community there. How do you deal with that criticism and what do you say to those haters?
I respect that position, and I know people are going to have a go, but I respect that position, and I'll do my best to help facilitate that you know, our sovereignty being acknowledged so that we can fulfill our life in this country and not be sick and dying and change some of these laws that continually oppress our people. I mean, we need to have the sovereignty movement still going. You know, this is not about taking that away. It's about strengthening that. So I don't, you know, I don't talk down about, oh, the mob. I respect that stance. It's certainly a stance that my own uncle has had all his life. And so I have the backing of my family. I feel like I've made a sacrifice in this regard, you know. So the rest of my family wouldn't do it, but I'm happy to make that sacrifice on behalf of my family and my people in swearing that allegiance. I wear my possum skin cloak as a protective measure that was given to me for protection. And, you know, that's why I wore it into the chamber, because I felt like I had that protection of my old people and my ancestors. So I go into this place with that in mind. And I, as I said, I respect that. I'm getting it from both ends at the moment, the sovereignty mob and the Uluru mob. I'm in the middle of those two, which, you know, I also respect. I'm listening to the people on the ground, the grassroots mob, and that's who guides me.
What about the whitefellas, the 97% that we need to understand our plight? You know, you've come out and you've said that you hate the flag and the anthem, which all us blackfellas do. How are you going to turn the 97% when you come out with statements like that?
Well, I think the same way I did in that interview, and that is, you know, it's if you feel the pain of someone not liking what you represent, then maybe start feeling the pain of what we feel when we're reminded of that oppressive, you know, agenda that was brought here by the colonizers, and understand that pain, understand why we don't identify with the Australian flag or stand to the Australian anthem. It's just not who we are as first people of this country. So I want to bring people on a journey of truth-telling, to be honest, and tell it in a way that we can try and get that 97%. We're not going to get the 97%, let's face it. But let's talk about a majority of the 97% coming along on this journey, and I think that that's starting to happen. People are starting to wake up. People are wanting to learn more about this country and the history. I've had people reach out to me who've read the Daily Mail and the right-wing, you know, paraphernalia that they put out, and done some more research on me, and has been completely converted. So we have an opportunity to educate this nation who's been in denial for too long, and this is our time in this country. They haven't looked after it. We're in a climate crisis, we're in an economic crisis, so it just goes to show how well they've looked after it since they've been here. We can show them how to look after it from now on.
If you're just joining us, Senator Lydia Thorpe is with us on Let's Talk today, and it's a pleasure to have her company. Lydia, what are you going to do to affect change for blackfellas in this country?
Well, my priority is treaty, and I know that the debate is going to be long about this. You know, the voice to parliament is not something that I've supported. I was there at Uluru, and you know, I don't need to go down the path of telling you the whole story. I'll come out with that story and hopefully get the whole walkout group to tell their story as well. But I think that a treaty is something that we should be pursuing. That'll give us seats in parliament, not a voice to parliament. We need to create real change, and having an advisory body to government is just the same old, and that's what I see the voice as. I'd rather go bigger and broader and call for a treaty that ends the injustices against our people and negotiate economic empowerment of our people, negotiate better outcomes for land rights. You know, native title is not been good for our people. It's been divisive and it caused a lot of harm to our people. So let's talk about land rights through treaty. Let's talk about reparations through treaty. Let's talk about seats in parliament and, you know, economic growth for our people instead of being sickest and poorest people in our own country. I have the First Nations portfolio, so treaty comes under that, and then I have the justice portfolio. So I'm pushing for the remainder of the recommendations into the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, also raising the age of criminal responsibility from 10 to 14, changing some of the laws, the racist laws that continue to lock our people up in this country. So that's justice portfolio. I mean, you know, there's so many other aspects, but they're the top three in terms of justice. And then sport. I mean, you know, we used to have the old footy netball carnivals, national carnivals. Where have they gone? Where have the events gone for our people that bring our people together to strengthen our people? So I'd like to see something like that. It's not on my priority list, but I want to be able to talk to Mob about how I can help facilitate that to happen. My priority in sport is about accessibility. You know, too many of our people don't participate because of affordability or transport or racism. A lot of our kids, you know, I come from Gippsland, where our kids just didn't participate in sport at the local level because of racism and you know, the cost of participation. So we need to level the playing field and not just have sports like gymnastics and tennis there for the rich fellas, and, you know, we're just only accessing the real basic kind of low-cost sport. We should be able to access every single sport that's out there and not have any barriers associated with it.
Senator, you're talking the long game there. We know it's a marathon, not a sprint. And we've seen some of our mob in Parliament in the past come out guns blazing, like Noba Peris, and it got to her. I mean, you're only one woman. How are you going to avoid that burnout or that toll on yourself?
Look, it's day three, and I've had plenty of meetings in this place already with people that you could not imagine. So I've already started to have yarns with people and give people a better understanding about the decisions that they're making in this place. I said hello to Pauline Hanson yesterday. She was a bit shocked. Well, she was sitting in my seat, actually, and it was, you know, from a division. So I said, "Hi, Pauline, how you going? I'm Lydia." And she said hi, and she congratulated me on becoming a senator. So we both smiled at one another, and that was it. But, you know, I know how to be professional. I know how to operate in a way where, you know, I'm not coming in here yelling and screaming. I'll respectfully approach people and continue to fight for what we want, but I'll do it in a more, you know, I'll do it differently. I'll operate differently. And I have a good supporting partner who has my back. I have my Greens colleagues who have my back, and I have a lot of community out there that have my back and send me messages of support. So I've seen a lot of our mob burn out from the struggle and the fight. I've learnt from that, and I do take time out. I've actually deactivated my personal Facebook for a little while just to have a breather, concentrate on my work here, and I'll come back when I'm ready. So yeah, we need to self-care. The struggle, you know, our ancestors fought and died for us. It's been going on for 240 years, so we have to self-care to be able to continue the struggle.
I was wondering why you didn't reply to my message on Facebook, but there you go. Hey, look, justice, it's a big portfolio and topic that is absolutely everywhere at the moment. We've seen since the beginning of the year the Black Lives Matter movement gain momentum and traction, but I'm still unsure whether that is for our mob or that was for Brother George over in the US. How do we get the momentum to continue and to get justice for the 441 mob who've lost their lives in custody?
We have to keep the pressure on. And yes, I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement was for the black man that died at the hands of the police in America, but it also woke this country in a way that they, you know, they were a bit surprised to hear that this happens, that happens here. And we need to take back that fight away from, you know, not let it get sidetracked by the BLM movement, and continue our fight for justice. We have to maintain the pressure. We have to pressure all sides of government to implement those remainder of those recommendations, and to change the racist laws that we have in this country. So we need our mob to pressure those parties, both Liberal and Labor, because we need Labor on board. We know a lot of blackfellas vote Labor. We know a lot of blackfellas are members of Labor. So we need to pressure them too. The Greens, you know, you won't have a problem with us. We'll stand up for what is right. But we need to continue those ones that say that they're our friends. But when, at the end of the day, in this chamber, their votes say something very different.
What about the representation of our mob in Indigenous affairs in our own sector? You know, talk of housing and other areas like that. What about the importance of that representation in our very own sector?
Look, I think it's important, but at the end of the day, they have to go, they have to follow the masters who set out the policy and the legislation. So, you know, they can only affect so much change. They still have to be guided by the policy that drives their work. They can make those organisations and those departments safe for Aboriginal people. But at the end of the day, how much change can you affect when the policy is what you work to? So I think, you know, maybe they can also put pressure on their superiors, their managers, on how that doesn't work for our people on the ground. I've worked for Centrelink. I left Centrelink when the welfare to work regime came in and they wanted me to go out to remote communities and get people signed up for Job Network. This is, you know, getting law men and law women to be signed up to Job Networks. I was absolutely insulted by that and left. I resigned. So, you know, it's up to people's own values as well on what they are willing to put up with within that environment. But, you know, don't stop questioning it and talk about how this really affects our people on the ground, because there's a lot of decisions that are being made, a lot of programs being developed without our people at the table saying what is best for us. We can't be dictated by governments on what is best for us. We have to say what is best for us. That is real self-determination.
Green Senator Lydia Thorpe is our guest on Let's Talk this morning. The importance of First Nations media, where do you see that importance on black media in this country? And you talk about truth-telling, we don't see it in mainstream. Is your focus going to be on black media as well?
I'll support black media whenever I'm called upon. I think black media is imperative for truth-telling in this country. I was on the Southeastern Indigenous Media Association board, I think, 25 years ago, which is now called 3KND. So black media is incredibly important. We just need to get that 97% of people watching it. I've been talking to a few government staffers here about watching black comedy and getting on NITV so they can understand my lingo and my language a bit. I think that it's very important, and you fellas need to be, you know, better resourced and whatever way I can help you to, you know, make that happen, you know, reach out. I'm happy to support where I can.
We'll hold you to that.
Absolutely.
Look, finally, I'm mindful of your time, Senator. What's the plan of attack? What's first on the agenda?
First on the agenda, well, today we're actually hope that the nukes bill doesn't come in, but, you know, the Bungala people have been fighting for country to stop this radioactive waste dump happening on country. They were denied any participation in the decision of that happening. So right now, today, it may be debated, and it's about you know, look at who votes with who in these places, and we need to get our people more in tune with how decisions are made in this place. So I think that's certainly, well, that's today's priority. I'm putting a motion forward today in the Senate, which I don't think I can talk about just yet because I'll have to surprise the House or the Senate on what that is, but it's certainly related to the way I walked into this place. So that's my priority. My priority is getting our people out of police custody, out of prisons, and stopping our people getting killed at the hands of this racist system.
Well, we wish
so many priorities.
Where to start? Look, we wish you all the best on your journey, sis, and we certainly appreciate you taking the time to have a yarn with us on Let's Talk today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Black fella, white fella, doesn't matter what you colour, as long as you are true fella, as long as you are real fella. All the people of different races, with different lives, in different places. It doesn't matter what your name is, we got to have lots of changes. We need more brothers if we're to make it. We need more sisters if we're to save it. Are you the one who's gonna stand up? Can you count it? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we shout it? Are you the one who's always ready with a helping hand? Are you the one who understands these family plans? Black fella, white fella, yellow fella, any fellow, doesn't matter what your color, as long as you are true fellow. All the people of different races, with different lives, in different places. It doesn't matter which religion, it's all the same when the ship is sinking. We need more brothers if we're to make it.
We need more sisters if we're to save it.
Oh, yeah. Are you the one who's gonna stand up and be counted? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we shout it? Are you the one who's always ready with a helping hand? Are you the one who understands these family plans?
And that's our show for this week. Thanks very much for your company. Of course, you can catch up on our website, 989fm.com.au. I want to thank our guests today, Uncle Willie Prince, and, of course, Senator Lydia Thorpe. I'm Dan Rennie. Have a great weekend. Let's Talk. We'll be back on Monday at 9. Have a good one.